You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell, and this is The Life Aquatic. Now, lots of us dream of quitting the rat race, but very few of us actually have the courage to do it. Even fewer have the courage to quit the rat race and then travel the world. Well, that is exactly what my guest is doing, and she's doing it in a boat. Kitiara Pasco is currently 900 nautical miles off Portugal. She's in the Azores, and she travelled there aboard her Nicholson 32. Kitiara, welcome to Boat Radio. How was your crossing to the Azores?
Hi. It was rough in places. It took us 27 days from the Bahamas to Flores, the island most remote in the Azores, but closest to the Bahamas. We travelled, I can't remember, I think 3,300 nautical miles over, yes, a month. We only got hit by two gales, which I consider quite fortunate, actually, because the North Atlantic has always scared me, the idea of crossing so far north. But it was good, in all.
So where did you set off from? Somewhere in the Bahamas?
Yes, we set off from Georgetown initially, although we did get becalmed on the first day, so we ended up in Conception Island for a lunch break. The second day, actually, I think. And then we set off that evening. It was very light wind for the first few days.
Well, lunch on an island sounds okay. You're not sailing single-handed then. Who are you with?
I'm with my boyfriend of 5 years. We've owned the boat for 3.5 years now. And yeah, he's the skipper when he feels like it or when he's not sleeping. So it's just the two of us and always has been. We've never had crew at all.
Right, and you're the first mate.
I am indeed the first mate.
So this is, you're getting kind of close to the culmination, I understand, of a two-year journey around the world. Have I got that right?
We've gone around the Atlantic. So we started from the UK in May 2014. And we didn't really know where we were going or how long we were going to go for. But we crossed the Atlantic to the Caribbean. And then we went up the West Indies and down to Panama. And then we sat in Panama for five months, waiting for the hurricane season to end and trying to decide whether we would go through the canal and round the world. But we decided that it's quite lonely sailing, and there are very few sailors our age to meet up with, and we were getting a bit, I suppose, homesick for our friends, really, more than the UK itself. So we decided that the crossing the Pacific would just take another 2 years, potentially 3 years, if we wanted to take our time, and we weren't prepared to do that. So we spent another year travelling back from Panama to here, and then soon to the UK.
Take us back to the beginning. How did this epic voyage begin?
Alex had a book in his bookshelf called Occupation Circumnavigation, and I can't remember who it's written by, and it's quite an old book, but it's about this sort of almost daft man who bought a large boat and took on loads of his friends as crew and sailed around the world and ran lots of charters. And Alex said, "Hey, look, wouldn't it be fun to sail around the world?" And I said, "No, not really. That sounds cold and wet and windy and horrible." But he kept pestering me, and I was working as an admin assistant in a law firm and very bored with the job. And eventually he said, "Look, I found this boat. It's old and needs a huge refit, but it's really cheap. And what do you say we buy it and set off sailing?" So I thought I would, humour him more than anything else. And I thought, well, this will make him happy. It'll give him a project to do. And, you know, he hates his job, so this will give him something to really enjoy. And yes, maybe we'll go sailing, maybe we won't. So I agreed.
Can I ask, how much did you pay for this boat?
I think it was £15,000.
Okay, so actually, that's a relatively small amount of money. That's less than you would pay for a new car.
Yes, exactly.
And had you sailed at all at this point? When you became when you became a boat owner for the first time, had you ever sailed one before?
No. The extent of my sailing experience was as a passenger on a wayfarer up the Lymington River when I was 15 years old, and I hated it. Other than that, I think I went on the Portsmouth to Santander P&O ferry once.
Wow, goodness me. So very little experience on the water. Gosh.
Yes, but Alex had sailed extensively.
Right, so he knew what he was doing.
Yes, his parents are avid sailors, and he spent his childhood sailing on a Moody 34 in the Solent and the Channel.
So when you tried it, were you immediately hooked?
No, I wasn't immediately hooked, because when I first tried it, we were sailing in the Solent. And actually, the first week that we did take the boat out, because she did require quite an extensive refit beforehand, there was no wind at all, and it was surprisingly hot. So I didn't really get a feel for sailing at all, and it just seemed a bit uncomfortable. And then the second time we went out, it was freezing cold, very windy, and the Solent was very choppy. And because I'd never sailed before, I pretty much genuinely believed that even wash from ferries going past would capsize us.
Okay, and yet here you are.
Yes.
Somebody's done a very good job of persuading you that this was the right thing to do.
Yes, and I'm not actually sure how it happened. I think Alex just kept telling me that it would be warmer the further south we went. And I think because I've always been in England, really, and next to the coast, I've always believed that the sea is inherently cold. And I really had no interest in being in it or on it. But he kept showing me these photographs and telling me these stories of the one time he went sailing in Fiji, and it did sound amazing.
But had you been, were you a well-travelled person? I mean, you're obviously a very well-travelled person now, but were you before? I mean, had you been on any holidays or exotic holidays?
Yes, I travelled across the United States with my best friend when I was in university, because I studied creative writing and I did my dissertation on travel writing. So I spent 2 months travelling across America. I was also brought up cycle touring, so I've cycled extensively throughout France, Spain, Denmark, Holland, you know, Northern Europe. You know, I've been to places like Greece, and Alex and I went on holiday to Indonesia once. Mm. So yes, I had travelled quite a lot, really.
So you've experienced those crystal clear blue waters of the warmer climates, which are so very much a contrast to the grey, almost granular, icy cold waters of southern Britain.
Yes, but it's so difficult to be on a cold boat in winter in the UK and really remember how warm those waters are in, say, somewhere like Indonesia. And I did know that they existed, but I just couldn't imagine the boat getting from the UK to those kind of waters, I suppose. But I did believe it at some level, because I did then agree to sail away from the UK.
You're on a Nicholson 32, right? Which is, they're nice boats. I know somebody who has a Nicholson 32, but they're quite, they're not roomy.
No, no. Someone once described it to me as a wardrobe on its side.
It's better than that. Well, it's more like modest caravanning of the sea.
Yes, we don't go very fast, and we only really have a saloon and a forepeak and a very, very modest bathroom. So yes, it's very small.
But, I mean, you can make them really comfy.
Yes, and she's very comfortable sailing in heavy weather. In large waves, she just sort of ploughs straight on through, really. She's very heavy for her size.
And so you've got that forepeak cabin, and then the saloon, and a modest bathroom, and I know that you don't have any of those fabulous mod cons like air conditioning and really nice cosy warm showers, but do you have a fridge?
We do have a fridge. The boat came with an ice box built in. The owner before us actually bought her from the factory, and he specified that he didn't want her fitted out before, so they made an exception, which they really didn't do at the time. Very often, and they gave him the hull of the boat, basically, I mean, the boat, but without anything inside. So he designed the galley, which is quite similar to the original plans, but yeah, there was sort of ice box in it, and we did fit a fridge plate in there. So we do have a fridge.
So you mentioned that Alex, your partner, didn't like his job. So is it fair to say that when you conceived of this voyage, you were running away from something rather than towards something? What I mean is you didn't have a sort of an ultimate goal.
No, we didn't have a goal. It was more like we had nothing keeping us in the UK anymore. When we bought the boat, I left my job and became a freelance copywriter. So I was working from home and could then work from anywhere in the world. And we'd got to sort of the age, I mean, I was only 24 when we bought the boat, but we'd got to the age where our friends had moved all over the country and all over the world, and we didn't really have a central point that we called home or any real reason to stay. We did want to travel extensively, by some means at least, and sailing, well, Alex loved sailing in the tropics, as he had done before, and I just wanted to see countries that I couldn't necessarily see easily otherwise, I suppose.
So how did you set about planning your trip? I mean, did you write a list of must-see places?
No. We knew how to get to the Caribbean, and it wasn't that we really, really desperately wanted to see the Caribbean, but that is certainly a route, perhaps one of the most straightforward routes if you're going to travel extensively by boat. We couldn't afford the Mediterranean at all, and so the Caribbean was going to be the cheapest place to go, really. So we knew how to get there from the UK down to Madeira and then the Canaries and then across to Grenada. So we sort of just stuck to that, really.
When you say you couldn't afford the Mediterranean, I mean, obviously anchorages are free. Do you mean sort of the cost of living?
Europe is just a very expensive, I mean, compared to places in the Caribbean and Central America, Europe is a much more expensive place to be. I also thought that I'd prefer to see more of Europe by land than I would by sea. But also places like if we needed to get into a marina, we just had the impression, I don't know where it was from really, but the impression from other sailors that we'd met and things we'd read, that the Mediterranean was in general quite expensive.
So, when did you set off?
We left our berth in Portsmouth in beginning of May 2014.
And where was your first stop?
Newtown Creek in the Solent.
Okay.
And we got there in a Force 8.
Ah, okay, right.
Which was not a very good day to leave.
Were you seeking sanctuary when you pulled in?
We were, and the harbourmaster was horrified that anyone had come out in such a horrible weather.
Well, let's say he was disappointed for you. And where did you point the boat after that?
Well, we went to Falmouth after that. And then waited until we had some good weather to go down to La Coruña in northern Spain.
These places that you go, when you were talking about the cost of things earlier on, presumably you find you're not pulling into marinas all the time, are you, unless you need fuel, right?
No, we're really only in marinas in places where we cannot anchor. So, for instance, I'm currently in a marina because you can't really anchor in the Azores very easily at all because they just go from 4,000 metres to, you know, the cliff face, and there's a plane flying overhead right now. So the Azores, we've been in marinas, but the marinas are very cheap here. For instance, currently we're paying just under €7 a night for everything.
€7 a night in the Azores?
Yes, and some of the Canaries are like that too. Fuerteventura, we're paying €6 a night. So we've been in only cheap marinas, and pretty much only in the European Atlantic islands where, as I said, the anchorages are not very safe.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. My guest today is writer Kitiara Pasco, who lives aboard a Nicholson 32. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, I'll be asking how she managed to break the shackles of ordinary life.
Hi, I'm Dave Dempsey from Marine Intelligence. If you're the owner or captain of a superyacht, then you know how expensive internet can be. And yes, it's a rip-off. We've made it our mission to revolutionize the world of marine communications. we will find you the best price for your internet by comparing all major vendors. And we do that for free. That's right, no charge to the boat. It's a free service. We get you the best price for your yacht, whether it's just one boat or a fleet of boats, and all the savings will be passed on to you. We can save you over $1,000 US per meg. So stop doing what you're doing and visit marineintelligence.net now, before you forget.
Hello, I'm Captain Bob May from Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show, and you're listening to Boat Radio.
Earliest prehistory reveals mankind's innate connection to the sea, from boats of woven reed in Egypt to Homer's black ships of the Trojan War, down to the naval battles of Greece, Rome, and every civilization since. I'm Brandon Huebner, and I'll present the history, archaeology, and literature that connect us with our past on the sea, all that on the Maritime History Program. Join me as we voyage down through the ages and witness the development of sailing, trade, and much more. The Maritime History Program, with me, Brandon Huebner, every Wednesday here on Boat Radio.
This is The Life Aquatic on Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. I'm talking to Kitiara Pasco about her journey around the Atlantic aboard a Nicholson 32. Kit, I think most people hearing this will want to know how you managed to survive, you know, without a regular job, either of you. And I wondered, because, you know, we were talking about the cost of marinas just before the break, you know, and you were wowing me with the low cost of a berth in the Azores. You'd pay an awful lot more than that in Mallorca, I tell you. But were you a writer? You mentioned about becoming a freelance copywriter. Before that, what, you worked in a law firm? And I wondered, did you take up writing because you thought that writing was something that you could do from anywhere and therefore could continue it on the boat? Was that the plan?
No, I've always been a writer. I studied it at university. I did a huge amount of writing in college. So the plan was always to work as a writer and somehow fund my life in whatever means that was, by writing, and preferably freelance writing. And it's obviously quite scary to quit a job, even if it was a very low-paying job like the one I had at the law firm. But I took the chance to quit that job and throw myself straight into freelance copywriting, and I signed up with a copywriting agency and got quite a lot of work and found my own clients. So it wasn't a leap for me. It wasn't just like I thought, I need a career that I can do from anywhere in the world. Hey, writing sounds good. I had always been writing, and I had been published in magazines just after I graduated, and I had been doing travel writing before that as well. I write for Yachting Monthly quite regularly. I think I've had around 10 articles published with them already, and they have quite a lot more.
I actually, I think, came across you, first of all, on Huffington Post. And I wondered, how did your connection with Huff Post come about?
Well, like I said, writing wasn't something that just struck me one day. I started writing for Huffington Post in, I think, early 2014, actually. But it was unconnected to sailing. I started writing more social commentary for them, just on their blog. And I have written about some travel writing there as well. But Huffington Post is more an opportunity for me to explore my sort of more social writing, really, than travel and sailing.
You're going to turn your adventures into a book, yeah?
I am, yes. And I have written quite a lot of it already. Liverboard sailing is a very slow way of life, so I have plenty of time to write. And have even written two fairly bad novels in the last 2.5 years while living aboard the boat. So I do write almost every day.
Are they published, the novels?
No, they are definitely put in drawers and never seen again.
Okay. Was that just something you had to get out of your system?
Yeah, I think, you know, you have these ideas, and I wanted to write a novel, and I sat down and wrote one while I was cruising the Atlantic Islands initially a couple of years ago, before we crossed the Atlantic the first time, and was amazed that I had managed to get to the end of a book without losing my steam. So I then started another one when we were in Panama and finished that quite recently as well. And I think with a lot of work, they could be readable, but I don't have time for it right now.
So we left you in La Coruña. Where did you head after La Coruña?
We spent a couple of months cruising the Spanish Rias after that, or somewhere which I'd never been before. And then we made it down to Povoa de Varzim in northern Portugal.
And did you stick to your kind of original rough route that you had in your head, or have you just let the wind blow you this way and that over the last couple of years?
We haven't really stuck to any particular route. We've been aware of the seasons, so we were aware that we needed to be in the Canaries sort of by November, December, so we could sail across the Atlantic with the trade winds. But we weren't in a particular rush. We sort of picked a window and went. After that, we were then aware that we had the hurricane season to deal with once we'd sailed around the West Indies. So we got to St. Martin at the top of the West Indies, and from there we were fairly certain that we were going to sail back across the Atlantic to the UK. We discovered that, as I said before, it's quite lonely, really. We met very, very few sailors remotely our age in the West Indies, and I think that the lifestyle was a bit of a shock to the system. And so we were provisioning to go back across the Atlantic when we decided fairly spontaneously that actually we were here, so we may as well go a little bit further. And we hadn't been to Central America at all, so we decided to sail to Panama the next week.
I mean, you were in the grip of homesickness, I suppose, for a little while, and then you overcame it.
Yes. Homesickness is an odd thing, because I've never felt it before, actually. When I was backpacking across the United States, I never once thought, hey, I miss the luxuries of home or anything, or my family or anything. It's never really occurred to me. I've always been quite happy. I've moved house a lot over the years and never really staying in one place for very long. But it was a homesickness for people our age and our friends back home, I think, mainly. We really miss just being able to hang out with our peers.
Essentially, you're saying cruisers are old. Liveaboard sailors are old.
Yes, they are. And it's understandable, because the majority of the boats that you see in the Caribbean especially are quite vast compared to ours. We're certainly the smallest boat in almost every single anchorage and even island, except for the French islands, which have some smaller yachts, which wasn't quite the case in the European Atlantic islands, which have much smaller boats, many our size. And we met quite a few young French sailors and young German sailors when we were in the Atlantic islands. But in the Caribbean islands, there are these, you know, large 45, 50 foot yachts, and obviously these are worth huge quantities of money. And so the people who own them are going to be older. They're going to be retired. There were some children around, but not really. Most were retired. They weren't families. And yeah, like, we did meet some very nice ones, but as I said, we are on a very different sort of lifestyle, really.
But have you made lasting friendships along the way?
Yes, we have. Mainly with sailors that we met in Portuguese and Spanish European islands when we first started the trip, because you tend to meet each other in more than one island, as everyone follows the islands through the chain. And so we have met a couple of lasting friendships, really, with especially French and German sailors. And then one South African sailor who we met in Grenada, and he was quite a character. And we met him up the island chain and then again in Panama. So yes, we have definitely made lasting friendships, but not as many as I think we had hoped for. It's very difficult to find young sailors. And when you do tend to flock together as well. I met a couple of Americans a few months ago now in the Bahamas, and I found them through Instagram, and they are the same age as us, late 20s, early 30s. And we sort of tracked each other down and, you know, sailed to an island and met in a bar, and were very determined we would meet each other, because we, both of us, had never, I mean, it had been a long time since we'd seen anyone our own age.
What about your old friends and your family? Have they visited you along the way?
My best friend and Alex's best friend both flew to Tenerife to see us when we were there, which was almost 2 years ago now. Otherwise, no. I speak to my friends a lot online, which is obviously very easy these days. when I have the internet, because the Caribbean does not have the internet connection that Europe does, and Central America certainly doesn't. I think I would have wanted to fly home if I hadn't had the internet connection that I have. So we speak a lot, but other than that, no, we haven't. No one's flown out. It's got a long way to go to the Caribbean.
I mean, I guess, you know, it's expensive. That's another problem, isn't it? It's expensive to get to the Caribbean and then to stay somewhere in the Caribbean. And the part of the problem, I suppose, if you're having a relatively small vessel, is that you don't have somewhere to accommodate people.
Yes, and not only can we not really accommodate people, but also we wouldn't go into a marina in the Caribbean because they're horribly expensive. And with change in the weather, you can never quite guarantee that you're going to make it to an island on the day that someone's flight might get in, or you can't guarantee that you're going to be in that anchorage when you say you will be, because perhaps, you know, the weather is not conducive to staying there. And it gets very difficult to ask someone, say, 3-4 months in advance to book a holiday on this week when you cannot guarantee that you're even going to be anywhere near that island. And that was really, I think, the main problem with people coming out. I mean, for instance, both my parents are freelance, so they have their own businesses 24/7. It's not really an option for them to take Caribbean holidays, especially when I can't guarantee that I'm even going to be in that particular country at any particular time. I think that's really the hardest part.
What do your parents think about your trip? I mean, did either of them try to persuade you, or dissuade you, I should say? Did either of them try to stop you from going?
No, not at all. They're both very adventurous as well in their own way. My mother particularly, she really loves to travel and loves to travel solo as well. She does a lot of cycling in other countries. But the thing is that when we left, we genuinely didn't know how long we were going to go for. And a large part of me probably thought we'd get to Falmouth or maybe France and then think, this is silly, let's go back. So when we left, I remember my dad saying, you know, oh, we'll see you in a couple of months when you get back. And while at the time I did think, oh, I'm not going to be back in a couple of months, you know, I don't think anyone really knew that we'd be gone for this long, and least of all us, really.
It sounds, forgive me, I don't mean to put thoughts into your head, but, you know, there's almost a reluctance, but I presume that you've really enjoyed your trip.
Yes, absolutely. I would say it's changed me a lot.
For the better?
Yes, 100% for the better.
In what way? Has it opened your eyes to things, or?
I think it's taught me that there's really very little that you can't do. When we arrived in Grenada, I was absolutely fascinated by the fact that the Caribbean was always something that I thought you had to buy a very expensive plane ticket to go to. I didn't realise, really, that it was possible to just get blown there by the wind for free. And I sort of felt like we'd snuck into the Caribbean through the back door, and that how did no one else realise that you could just sail across the ocean and do that? And it's not like we have, as you said, fancy gadgets. Like, we don't even have a water maker, we don't have an oven, we don't have a shower. You don't need any of that stuff. You can just travel around the entire world if you wanted to by the energy of the wind. And I think the freedom that I discovered while sailing has really changed who I am. I wouldn't say I was a reticent person before, but I certainly was aware of, I suppose, self-imposed limits, and now I'm aware that that's just not true. You can really do anything.
This is The Life Aquatic on Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. It's time for another short break. When we come back, I'll be asking Kitiara about the amazing sights she has seen.
Hi, I'm Sarah O'Kelly, founder of Skipper's Review. I started Skipper's Review because I wanted somewhere online for my local boating community to make connections and recommendations. So now it's up and running. I've been getting out of the office to enjoy the Florida sunshine and to meet some of my members. Each week, you can hear me swapping salty tales with sailors, surfers, swimmers, divers, boat owners, and builders, anyone with a story to tell about their life and their relationship with the sea. So join me, Sarah O'Kelly, with Skipper's Review on Boat Radio.
I'm Michael John, and each month on Boat Radio, I'll be looking at life on London's magnificent River Thames, from the dredgers emptying their cargoes of sand and gravel to the mudlarks combing the shore for lost treasures. I'll be meeting the people, visiting the places, and boarding the ships that work this mighty, muddy artery. So join me, Michael John, for Tales of the Thames on Boat Radio.
This is Edward Smith from OPA Racing.
This is Ken Little, president of GLOC Performance Boat Challenge.
Hi, this is Frank Pillsbury with Marine Max and the DFW International Boat Show in Dallas, Texas.
We explore all kinds of boating topics on Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show. Hi, I'm Captain Bob May. We get underway, making way, Saturday evenings here on Boat Radio.
This is Heather Lohe, Director of Membership for Boat US. Thanks for listening to Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell, and this is The Life Aquatic. My guest is Kitiara Pasco, blogger at The Huffington Post and contributor to Yachting Magazines. Kitiara left the UK a little over 2 years ago and has since sailed all around the Atlantic aboard her Nicholson 32. Kitiara, let's talk about some of the amazing places you've visited. What do you think will be your abiding memory of this trip?
That's a good question. I think probably arriving in Panama after 12 days crossing the Caribbean Sea, which was, while in the West Indies there are jungly islands, and there are white sand beaches and palm trees everywhere, they are small islands and a lot of them are quite well inhabited. Whereas sailing across the Caribbean Sea was this endless stretch of water, the sun was boiling hot, and then one day we just arrived in what I would call a true jungle, and it absolutely blew my mind. Panama was just completely wild, absolutely wild, and even the towns there are these fantastic wooden buildings that completely suit the jungle around them, and the jungle is just left to its own devices. It's really incredible.
What is Turada Acorda?
Turada Acorda is Portuguese for bull on a rope.
I speak a little bit of Spanish because I live in Mallorca. I don't speak Portuguese, but yeah, it's bull on a rope.
Yeah.
It's not soap on a rope. So what do you do with bull on a rope?
This is a particular, I suppose, sport in the Azores. And while the Spanish have their bullfighting, which is something I actually don't agree with at all, the Portuguese put a bull on a very, very long rope indeed. Not a particular feature for safety, more that you can rein it in at the end of the event, I suppose. And then the bull will go running off through the streets of the town, or in the case where I saw it recently, it was on a commercial quay and a large space had been created by large shipping containers, hemming it in on three sides and water on the fourth side. And local men will run around the bull, they'll wave at it, they'll flap towels at it, open umbrellas in its face, and get a charge at them, after which they will zoom off as fast as they can for cover and safety. The idea of it is that you touch the bull on the forehead between its horns and run away without it hitting you. It is definitely a spectacle to be seen. And the bulls are surprisingly quick on their feet and often catch men unawares and will flip them up over their heads. Mostly the men just hop up again, grinning and run away, and everyone cheers.
And how did you get on?
Well, it was interesting. So I was sat on top of a shipping container, which was a really interesting place to be, actually, because the bull would come right up to the bottom of the shipping container that I was sat on, and it would be just meters away from my feet, huffing and pawing the ground and glaring at whatever man was trying to enrage it at the time. And we had four bulls, and one at a time, and it was actually, it was good fun, because we had, as I said, the quayside. So a lot of men and even boys, teenagers, would be sat on the quayside, and when the bull would run up to them, they would be able to jump straight into the water. And people were laughing, and it was enjoyable until the last bull charged at a group of men who did not have time to run between the containers like they had been before, and the bull caught two of the men and flipped them very violently above his head and slammed them into a shipping container. And one of the men did not get up again and was taken away by paramedics. But the most surprising part of it was not the injury of the man, I suppose. It was more the reaction of the crowd, which was as if this is completely normal. No one was surprised. No one was screaming or crying. It was very, this is just what happens.
I suppose if you are going to continue to make a bull more and more angry and then get as close to it as you can, then someone's going to get hurt, aren't they?
Absolutely. And it's not just a case of, oh, someone got hurt, that was, that happened. They make DVDs, and the DVDs are of just these clips where people get really hurt. And it's just that, it's almost a celebration of it. This is what we do, we play with fire, and we get burnt, but, I mean, that's kind of the point, in a way.
Very, very odd. I can't imagine wanting to take part in something like that. What's Pisco? Am I even pronouncing that correctly?
I think it's Pisco, with the Spanish E for the I.
Pisco. Ah.
Pisco is it's like a fortified wine of Peru. It's sort of the national drink there. It's quite sweet. They have different variations of it. But it's a huge part of the culture of Peru. And they have a drink called Pisco Sour, which is Pisco, the wine, mixed in with raw egg white and perhaps another ingredient, I can't remember, sugar or something. And yes, when we left the boat in Panama for hurricane season, we were in Panama for most of the time doing work on the boat. But we flew down to Peru for 3 weeks to make the most of the fact that Panama is really a crossroads of the Americas. And it's very easy to get to other American countries. So we spent a few weeks in Peru, and yes, we did a lot of Pisco sampling. And it's a very interesting taste, which I would not necessarily indulge in again.
I have to say, it doesn't sound great.
No, it causes people to pull some very funny expressions. But the Peruvians adore it. They really, really enjoy it.
Obviously, you know, although it was slightly odd, experience. The baiting the bull is something that you will remember for a very long time, as is drinking Pisco in Peru. Your abiding memory, you said, was crossing the Caribbean Sea and suddenly coming upon the dense and wild jungles of Panama. What's the loveliest town that you've been to, do you think, on your trip?
That's a really good question as well, and a difficult one. I would say the loveliest town I've been to was, and I think it's a bit biased because of my experience immediately before it, but probably, well, I was going to say Flores, actually, in the Azores, which is a really, really tiny island, and the town there, Lages, was just so European and friendly and welcoming after what was quite a stressful Atlantic crossing. But another town I really enjoyed was Santa Cruz in Tenerife. Because it's quite a large, I mean, it's the capital of Tenerife, but it's not in the tourist area. So it still retains its very unique Canarian culture and atmosphere. And it's just an absolutely beautiful town to be in. And we spent 3 or 4 weeks there preparing to cross the Atlantic the first time. And I don't know, I have really fond memories of Tenerife. We also met quite a lot of young sailors there, which was one of the few places that we did. And we spent a lot of time on and off each other's boats and, you know, talking about our various adventures and plans. And it was, I have very fond memories of that place.
If you did the trip again, how would you do it differently?
I would take less clothes because my wardrobe, I use the term very loosely because my wardrobe is actually the empty space below my bed. So every single time I want to take an item of clothing out, I have to unmake the entire bed. But it has a ridiculous amount of clothes in it, all of which are really, really warm jumpers and thick T-shirts and jeans and things like that, and a bizarre amount of hiking socks that I have never worn. because I think I honestly did not believe that the sea could be hot and that sailing could be hot and tropical, really. So I took so many clothes designed for the cold weather with me, and I've carted them around for 2 years, and they have just been the bane of my life because they take up so much room. So that's what I would do differently. I would take less clothes.
Actually, I think that reflects really rather well on the whole trip. If the only adjustment that you would make if you had to do it again was that you would take different clothes. Because you could have said, well, if I did it again, I wouldn't take Alex. Or if I did it again, I'd do it on a bigger boat or something like that. Or I would have visited such and such a place. But obviously, it's worked out really well if that's been the only problem. You know, you've ended up spending your entire time in bikinis and flip-flops. It's not so terrible, is it? Not such a terrible way to live.
Yeah, no, I really have no regrets.
How would you describe now your relationship with the ocean, which you regarded as a cold, forbidding place, as your packing suggests, before you left? How would you describe your relationship with the sea now?
My relationship with the sea has changed so hugely. It's really almost unrecognisable. I really did see the sea as a cold, forbidding place. And I saw it as almost like an entity that was hell-bent on destroying the boat, on destroying anything that dared to cross it or attempt something with it. I thought that large waves were something almost malicious. And now it's really changed. Now I understand that the weather is not something to be beaten or complained about, and the sea is not something to be conquered. And I think that has always been quite a stark attitude of a lot of people, is that the sea is something to be conquered. And it's really not. It's something to be worked with. And, you know, large waves can be frightening and they can do damage, but at the same time, if you go with them, for instance, then they can be a fantastical ride. And even in our heavy and slow boat, you know, she is very light-footed when she's streaming down the face of large waves. And it's kind of a beautiful, magical moment when you realise that you can just work with the ocean instead of trying to fight against it, because you cannot fight against something so huge and awe-inspiring. You have to work with it. And it's that moment when you work with the wind and the waves and even the temperature, that's when you really connect with the ocean, I think, and realise how it's utterly conducive to living. It's not something, it's not a barrier and it's not an obstacle to cross. It's something to enjoy and partner up with, really.
Well, that's a very good answer. Kitiara, tell us again, where can we find your work, your writing?
My website is called theliterarylifeboat.com. And on there, you can read my blog, which I did write extensively in the first year of the travels, especially. Less so these days, because I've been focusing on writing a book of travel writing about the voyage. But still, I do blog on that website. And also, there are links to my Yachting Monthly articles and my Huffington Post articles on that website as well. And that's the best place to find my work and get in contact with me.
Okay, and do you have any idea what the book will be called? Is it that far advanced?
I do have some ideas, but I'm keeping them close to my chest in case in several years' time I find them so ridiculous that I never want anyone to know what I thought I would call it.
Fair enough. Well, we'll look out for Kitiara Pasco. In the meantime, thank you so much for talking to Boat Radio.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed myself.